Hello and welcome to the new episode of Newton Talks. This one's entitled The Best Films of 2019. But in reality, it's really my favourite films of 2019. There's absolutely no attempt here to be objective whatsoever. But to save it from just being a very obvious list of my own personal favourites, I've also got some guests joining me later to talk through what they felt were their favourite movies of this year. So I'm going to run down my top five, interspersed with my guests. So at number five, I've chosen S. Craig Zahler's Dragged Across Concrete, starring Mel Gibson and Vince Vaughn as corrupt cops out to shake down some criminals. They don't know what they're attempting to do. Turns out they're robbing a bank. S. Craig Zahler also directed Bone Tomahawk and Brawl in Cell Block 99, two fantastic pulpy movies that I recommend you check out. Dragged Across Concrete very much is in the vein of those films. Zahler uses a kind of core stable of actors, including people like Vince Vaughn, Jennifer Carpenter, Udo Kier, and Don Johnson. They all turn up in this movie. Zahler's films are very slow burning, lots of long takes, lots of silences, and he stretches out what is often exploitation pulp material to extreme lengths. And Dragged Across Concrete is no different. It's very much a stakeout film with long, drawn out scenes of Gibson and Vaughn sitting in cars, watching and waiting for something to happen. Like Brawl in Subplot 99 and Bone Tomahawk, it's extremely violent, but the most effective scene is a little deviation away from the main plot, where we see Jennifer Carpenter's character of a new mother going back to work in a bank, and the film deviates away from Gibson and Vaughn's characters for about 10 minutes. And it is a scene that ends in a way that seems rather obvious in retrospect, but at the time you're not quite sure where it's going, and it is very effective, very moving, and also incredibly shocking. Number five on my list of the best films of 2019, Dragged Across Concrete. So I'm here with Dr. Francis Cam, lecturing film at the University of Kent. Francis, what was your favourite film of 2019?
Okay, big question. I have picked Judy and Punch as directed by Mira Fulks. I'm sort of tentative around the word favourite because I would say it's not a film without its problems, but I think it's by far one of the most interesting films that's come out this year. So,
what was interesting about it?
Well, several things. I don't think you know too much about it, Ray.
No.
It is a kind of loose, I guess, both adaptation but also origin story for kind of Punch and Judy, right? So for that tradition, which is very much associated with like English seaside, right? The idea of these kind of marionette performances, and it's kind of an origin story of where that came from, and the actual sort of the real sort of Punch and Judy behind the show, right? The creators of it. As you can probably tell from the title that it's Judy and Punch, it's not just kind of origin story, but it's also sort of reverse in it. It's sort of a feminist retelling of that origin story and rethinking through and challenging some of the misogynistic kind of underlines, right, that is inherent in sort of the tradition that is Punch and Judy, which is, after all, a guy who happens to be a domestic abuser, right, beats up his wife, beats up his children, etc. So it's an origin story of that, but it kind of plays with that tradition, actually kind of puts the emphasis on Judy as the main character. So very briefly, I guess the kind of the plot of the film is that you find out that Punch is this very kind of popular puppeteer, bit of a celebrity who runs this show with the puppets that has the characters that we all know, the kind of the Punch and the Judy characters, along with the others like the baby and the crocodile, the others from that tradition. But it transpires that actually, I guess, the brain behind it all is actually his wife, right? So it's actually Judy. So she's the one that seems to be kind of the most talented, both in terms of sort of operating the puppets, but also with their sort of business plan, shall we say, because it transpires that actually he is a bit of a drunk, a bit of a layabout, you know, he's unfaithful. So whilst being a celebrity, actually, she is behind their success.
What's the kind of aesthetic of this? Is it kind of absurd? Does it mirror the puppet show?
Yeah, I mean, the aesthetic, in a sense, is perhaps one of the main reasons why I've picked it, because it's really unusual. It is historical, of course, but it's also quite out of time. It's got a sort of a vague setting that is sort of in the past, in this sort of vague past where, you know, they stone women for being witches. That's kind of, you know, one of the sort of main opening scenes in a way. But it's also very ahistorical, or kind of out of time as well. That's what's really fascinating about it. And that sort of reflects, it's not just kind of aesthetically, but also in terms of the tone too. It's sort of, it does something quite interesting with, you know, what is quite a serious topic, but there are comedic elements worked in there too. So you kind of, I think you do buy into it in terms of the authenticity of the setting, which is kind of created by this sort of unique aesthetic, and yet it is also out of time. So that's one of the really intriguing, I think, strengths of the film.
Number four on my list of the best films of 2019 is Mark Jenkins' Bait, a British film that's gathered a lot of attention this year, particularly on the art house scene. The film is set in a Cornish fishing village, and it's a really sharp class analysis and a kind of takedown and critique of gentrification, middle class gentrification. The most striking thing about the film, for anyone who's seen it, will know that it's the style. It was shot on 16mm. A clockwork Bolex, with no sync sound, so all the sound was completely built in post-production, and the images were hand-processed. It's got a really folky, evocative visual aesthetic. The folkiness of it reminded me of British films from the 1970s, like Winstanley by Kevin Brownlow, and a Requiem for a Village by David Gladwell. The look of the film is really kind of poetic and moody. There are lots of shots of kind of the beach and kind of rolling waves, and a very kind of grainy look to it. But also the film's got a lot of a big sense of humour. So number four on my list of the best films of this year, Bait. So I'm here with Dr. Chris Deasy, and Chris is one of the few people I know who goes to the cinema quite so much, three or four times a week sometimes.
Oh, at least.
At least, okay. So he's actually an authority on this, unlike myself, in that I haven't seen that many films this year. Chris, you've seen hundreds this year.
Well, I worked out, yeah, so I thought if I see even as many as five a week, so I can't do the sum, it must be like 250 a year at the cinema.
250 a year at the cinema. What are your? I've allowed you to whittle it down to two of your favourite films. So, what have you gone for?
Well, the two—they both start with G. So it looks as though I've just sort of randomly thought, well, these are the best films starting with G. But no, actually, I think they are the best I've seen this year. One is a British thriller, and it's called *The Good Liar*. A very good acting tour de force for Ian McKellen and for Helen Mirren. And the other one is *Gloria Bell*, which is an American remake of a South American film. Which also, both of them very sort of dealing with relationships of the disconnect between different characters who are going through midlife or later life, in the case of The Good Liar, post-divorce paths.
So there's a kind of convergence there with some of the themes and ideas, you think?
Yes, I hadn't thought of that, because we were just, before we started recording, I was sort of saying, well, I whittled it down to about like 19 or 20 films that could be in my top 20, but I chose these without thinking that there could be a connection. But there's a very big connection. And the interesting thing there is that there are characters who are struggling with, whether it's the dating scene in the case of Gloria Bell, or in the case of the other film, dealing with the whole issue of like long-term failure to understand how somebody else has really spoiled somebody's life, and the way that this fest is a bit like the Count of Monte Cristo, I suppose. The whole notion of what do you do when somebody has injured you? How do you work that through? And of course, this becomes a revenge fantasy, but you never quite know who's playing whom. And I think the film really works because it taps into something that I think we all relate to, of what happens when somebody sort of kind of, you misread somebody or somebody does something and you feel that the only way you can deal with that is to sort of play their game and sort of say, right. And, you know, that's certainly what happens in The Good Liar, where you have Helen Mirren, who has a backstory that equals the one that Ian McKellen, who seems at first, we sort of know that he's not all that he seems, but it seems that that goes for Helen Mirren as well. And I think that it's an acting tour de force. That's what makes the film so powerful. But I think that it's really good in terms of the way it sort of plays on this whole notion of emotional, psychological turmoil, the possibility of obtaining, let alone seeking, closure.
Did you find The Good Liar? You said you described it as a thriller. How excited were you whilst watching it? Does it very much come across that?
It was, because the trailer had been very it'd been a very kind of tantalising thriller trailer to watch, because it showed you there was a clear suggestion that somebody was playing somebody else. And I think what worked there is it was tapping into the dating scene. It was tapping into the use of the internet, the way in which people wear masks. The film itself was very good at showing this whole sense that people meet, they think they know the other person's name, they don't, they believe somebody's backstory, they take it very seriously. But then it turns out that, of course, somebody might have a reason for trying to acquire somebody else's trust. It might be financial, it might be a control freakery. And I think that what sort of worked here was this sort of notion of having one of the characters as an academic, Helen Mirren, we are led to believe, whether this bit of the story is true, we don't know, who was supposed to have been a university don. She was a history lecturer. And she is somebody who, in her 70s now, goes on the internet, and we're meant to think, you know, doesn't really know what she's doing. We don't know that, you know, she's inviting all these men into her world. And it turns out that maybe the meeting between her and Ian McKellen has not been entirely random. But we assume that he can see that she must have some money. She's a widow. She lives in a big property. She pays for everything by cash. So it suggests that she's got this money flying around, and maybe she's not very careful. And he sees an opportunity here to interweave himself into her world. But then it sort of goes down a very interesting path where it turns out that her supposed grandson is doing a PhD. So there's obviously a lot of sort of academia in there. Obviously there was something I thought, yes, I can relate to that. But there was something about her grandson who was supposed to be doing a study of Nazi war criminals. And I won't, without giving too much away, the film kind of then goes down a particular path that shows that there's a very big backstory that goes all the way back to the 1940s. So it's like 70 years to get you know, for payback.
And you described it, you said it does what good cinema should do. You mentioned
that you don't know where it's going, and you sort of feel that maybe that, you know, there are going to be some plot twists, but it's satisfying to wait until the end, because you kind of, but what you enjoy along the way is not so much the you know, who's telling the truth. It's called The Good Liar, and of course you can look at it two ways. It's like somebody's very good at being a liar, or indeed, you know, all the oxymoron of being a good liar, but or not so much a good liar, and then what happens when somebody's story unravels. So it was very good, because right to the end you don't quite know. It doesn't really matter who's playing whom. What you just see, it warrants a second viewing, by the way, because then you can sort of pick up on all the threads that the first time around you think might be suggesting that, you know, somebody knows more than they're letting on or whatever. But it kind of works about, you know, somebody has lost a husband, they are vulnerable, and the way that somebody then offers themselves as the perfect alternative or the perfect substitute, and then the way in which that then falls into a narrative of, you know, somebody then seemingly giving their life to another, and but that person then clearly having a very different face-to-face relationship with them to then how they might appear when that other person is not on the scene. So it's the mask slipping all the way through it. And of course, sometimes in a dating type scenario, it's very easy to think, oh, this person seems to represent all the things I cherish, and they seem to have all, you know, they're just saying what they want you to hear. But in the good thing about The Good Lie is that it works both ways. So it's kind of a good game of psychological manipulation, but grounded in something. It's certainly grounded in the 1940s, but it's also grounded very much in this whole sense of why anybody would go online and meet somebody who is just a facade, is just a persona. And I think the film is very good at deconstructing the personas of people and playing on the fact that no matter how educated somebody might be, no matter how seemingly together they may be, there are always going to be buttons that can be pressed, and they're going to be sort of sent down a path of, you know, of confusion and manipulation and losing control.
And what about Gloria Bell? What was it you liked about that?
What I liked about Gloria Bell was that it was, you know, a bit like Al Pacino in Cruising, you know, where he's got this the two lives. He's the policeman by day, and then by night he goes into sort of S&M clubs, and it's all sort of, yes, that's part of his job. He's an undercover police officer, but he no longer knows the difference between the two. And I think what worked in Gloria Bell is you've got someone who by day has a job, but she's very sort of straight-laced, or she works, I think, in a bank, and everything, you know, but she's also divorced. But she also then, grown up family, and lacks connection, but it's the music from the 70s and 80s. There's lots of Earth, Wind and Fire for it, and also that Love Is in the Air, John Paul Young, and you've got lots of sounds from a different era, and of course the Gloria itself from Laura Branigan, and that's her connection. That's almost the pivot, that's the thing that gives her balance, that she's hopeless at relationships. She has a daughter who's got pregnant by a man she's barely met, who does all these sort of like free soloing type things. I think it's to do with water, though. And, you know, he everything he does is risky. And it's like, well, you want to have a child with him, you want to move to Australia with him, but like he may not survive the next wave, you know, he goes surfing waves or whatever. So there's all of that. And so her life is completely out of balance, but she goes to nightclubs every night. And then she meets men who, of course, similar to The Good Liar, I'm realising the connections are more than just they start with the G, is that she meets somebody who says that he himself is going through a divorce. It turns out that maybe he's not divorced, and it turns out that maybe he's a lot closer to his wife, and he can't bring himself to leave the family dynamics, which we see in the background, for Gloria Bell. And then when he does go on holiday with her, he keeps coming, you know, returning. He keeps, you know, he just leaves, there's more than one occasion, he just leaves her stranded. So all the way through this is the sense of what is her control? What is her way of finding an equilibrium or balance when everybody is giving her this sort of, expectations and hopes that are then unable to be realised.
Okay, number three on my list is Martin Scorsese's The Irishman. Some of you may have seen this on Netflix. Some of you may have been fortunate enough to see this when it was released on the cinema for 2 or 3 weeks prior to its Netflix release date. Clearly, the most striking thing about the film is its cast. Pacino, De Niro, Joe Pesci, including Harvey Keitel, Stephen Graham, etc., etc. And also the rather alarming use of CG to de-age the actors, which has led to some criticism that it's not 100% convincing, and there is a kind of lizard-like quality to them, I think. But at the same time, the acting talent, you know, really shines through, and it's not something that bothered me too much, even though I don't think it was as effective as the de-aging of Samuel L. Jackson in Captain Marvel. It's an incredibly subtle film, I think, which some people, I don't think, quite appreciated. It's clearly not a film like Casino or Goodfellas. It's not especially flashy. Instead, it goes for far more sedate kind of meditation on aging, I suppose. But many, many scenes are extremely funny. Just wonderful cinema. Two scenes in particular where you have face-offs between a gangster played by Stephen Graham, the British actor, and Al Pacino playing Jimmy Hoffa, one in prison and one post-prison when they meet up to try and negotiate with each other, are just two fantastically acted, utterly hilarious scenes. Those who've watched the film will know what I'm talking about. Another favourite scene of mine is the scene in the hotel late on when Joe Pesci informs De Niro's character that he's going to have to go and kill Jimmy Hoffa. And it's just a really tender scene between two of them. There's a kind of father and son style interplay between them, where Joe Pesci, you know, asks the De Niro character whether he wants cornflakes before he tells him of what is about to happen. I also thought there was a kind of accord with Sergio Leone's Once Upon a Time in America from 1984, another De Niro gangster film that features Joe Pesci in a small role. Once Upon a Time in America, some people have said that the whole film plays out like an opium dream. The film begins with De Niro's character visiting an opium den, and he ends in the same opium den, almost as if everything that happens in between, which is a very long film, you know, 3 hours or over 3 hours, is some form of opium hallucination. Well, what happens in The Irishman is that it begins in an old people's home and it ends in an old people's home. And so there's almost a suggestion that this stuff may have been a kind of dream or fantasy from the central character. Also, I read once that Leone wanted to do a quite an elaborate scene for Once Upon a Time in America where a car goes over a bridge into a river, and as the car settles down at the bottom of the river, you see other cars and debris and guns that have also gone into the river from the past. And The Irishman, I'm sure coincidentally, features a scene where De Niro's character, hitman character, throws a gun away into a river, and the camera follows as the gun settles down on the riverbed, and there's dozens of other guns that have been thrown there and used in murders. I thought that was a nice little touch. So number three on my list, The Irishman. So I'm here with Dr. Nigel Mather from the School of Arts. Nigel, you've picked what some people might think is a surprising choice. You've picked the new Paul Feig film, Last Christmas, which has to be said, did not get, it's much maligned and didn't get very good reviews. What's your reasoning behind picking this film?
I think it's been nobody would deny this, a very difficult year in Britain. The whole Brexit thing was dragged on. We've recently, in a sense, had a kind of second referendum, I suppose, to try and finalise this one way or the other. And Last Christmas is a film which, in a very indirect way, is talking about Britain's identity. And, you know, as the title suggests, Last Christmas really, it's drawn from a George Michael song. And one of the reasons it was derided was, certainly by Mark Kermode, was because it takes a line from that song. Last Christmas, I gave you my heart, and the very next—I can't remember the last part. The very next day, you gave it away, or something or other. And I apologise for anybody who's not seen the film at this stage. But the twist is that the main character, Emilia Clarke's character, the woman originally from Yugoslavia, but now resident in Britain with her family. She is only alive this Christmas because of a heart transplant from a man who died in a bicycle accident the previous Christmas. I don't know why you're laughing. This is quite a serious matter in the film.
Okay.
But I think you touch on something interesting here in terms of the genre, really, because on the one hand, it's very clearly wanting to set itself up, I suppose, as a Christmas movie. That would be its genre. But it is also something of a tragicomedy, and I think this is one of the reasons that people, such as Mark Kermode, had some difficulties in dealing with it, really. He felt that getting through the film was a little bit what he called trying to survive a snowdrift. And the Daily Mail, rather tastelessly, I thought, in a way, but I mean, I suppose the reviewer is entitled to his opinion. This is Brian Vine, I think his name is. And he said it was very sad that George Michael died a couple of Christmases ago, but one consolation for him was that he didn't see how his music was being used in this film. And I suppose the criticism would be that this line has been taken a bit too literally, and that it lends itself to, you know, a certain level of absurdity. I suppose to go back to your original question, why I chose this, and again it would tie in, I think, with this being, you know, a very traumatic year in Britain. And I think this is a film that is concerned about Brexit. Emma Thompson is very much somebody who's been very against it. And she does have some moments where Yugoslavian characters are kind of told to get back to their own country and so on. And I think in the film she is trying to make a point that this kind of behaviour is not really part of what we might call the best of British in a way. And I think she's keen to present a view of Britain as a welcoming place. Homelessness plays a kind of key part in the story. And there is a kind of homage, as you might expect, I suppose, from Paul Feig, as an American director, to Hollywood cinema. And I think the link with Christmas movies would be with It's a Wonderful Life. Because Amelia Clarke's character in the film, through realising what's happened, that this boyfriend she thought she had is actually just somebody in her imagination, really. She's thinking back to what this man might have been like before he died and allowed her to live with a heart transplant. And I think it is about her becoming a better person. She's presented at the beginning as charming and funny, but thoughtless, not really interested in friendship, not somebody who can be relied upon even to lock the shop up where she works. And towards the end of the film, she does work in a kind of homeless unit. And the film, and I think this is where I would say it is very moving, or certainly I was moved by it, it does move towards her singing Last Christmas for a benefit night for the homeless. And I think this ties in a little bit with really two films we talked about in our previous podcast, Fighting for My Family and Wild Rose, which were both films, interestingly, about women characters who didn't want to just settle down and, you know, have an ordinary life. They did have a kind of dream and an ambition, which was not easily accomplished in these films. And Last Christmas, I think, is different to those, but it's also drawing upon that kind of idea that Emilia Clarke's character is not going to become a star, but she is a kind of star for that one evening when she sings this song. And it is, I think, a beautifully funny moment and very, very moving. And the film is by no means kind of straightforward, really. There could be a criticism made that the casting, I know you're a little bit surprised by this, Emilia Clarke, I think she's from Oxfordshire or somewhere or other, she's playing the Yugoslavian character. And some people might particularly be taken back by Emma Thompson playing a Yugoslavian character with a very kind of broad kind of comic accent to some extent. And she at the end, because the film is not entirely politically correct, her character blames this Brexit thing on the Poles, really. That there've been too many Polish people in Britain, and you know, now it's been taken out on the Yugoslavian people. But the film, I think, just to round off, I think it is very moving. It's not cynical. It is sincere. It does make a point about love and death, really, that all the people we love are eventually going to die, and, you know, there will be that feeling of loss. And I think the main reason I was taken with the film was Amelia Clarke, really, because I must admit, I knew the name, and I knew she was very prominent in Game of Thrones, but I didn't know her work. And I think in this film, I don't think it'd be too far to say, really, that every time she is in shots, and she's wearing a very kind of fetching green elf outfit, it could be von Sternberg directing Marlene Dietrich. I think, really, she has that kind of charisma. I think she is so sort of photogenic. And there are elements also of Goldie Hawn, I think, of, you know, women performers who are very good with humour and irony. And I would recommend it, despite what, you know, the Daily Mail and Mark Kermode felt about it. I think it is a film that will become, in a way, a kind of cult movie, but it's also, I think, destined to become a certain kind of classic Christmas film. And it is a film about positive values in a British context in these troubled times.
Okay, number two on my list of the best films might actually be my favourite film of the year. But it comes in at number two because it's Quentin Tarantino's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. And I've already talked about this film in quite a bit of depth in episode 6 of New to Talk. So if you're interested in my thoughts on that film, please go and check out that podcast. Very briefly, one of the most kind of enjoyable films of the year. I think it's got some real depth to it. Again, a kind of slow burning movie, not dissimilar to The Irishman in terms of its pace and tone, but with some very flashy, beautifully realised moments. So number two on my list, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. So number one on my list of my favourite films of 2019 is Joker, directed by Todd Phillips. Now, I've always been a fan of Todd Phillips. He's got a very interesting past, one of the organisers of the New York Underground Film Festival, but he's probably more famous for doing comedies, The Hangover, an old school. I'm a big fan of The Hangover franchise. I think it's underrated as a film, and with something like The Joker, he's really coming into his own as a filmmaker. Obviously, a lot of the plaudits are going to go to Joaquin Phoenix for his performance as Arthur Fleck, who becomes the Joker. But I also think Todd Phillips should take some of the credit for some really beautiful direction. Obviously, the film is deeply influenced by Martin Scorsese. One of the only original elements of the film is the bringing the Scorsese style that he've kind of followed in King of Comedy and Taxi Driver and putting that into a superhero world or a superhero narrative. One of the things I liked most about Joker, it was probably the best time that I had in the cinema all year. I watched the film after it being out for 1 week on Friday at about 5 o'clock, and it was a massive audience, and probably the most diverse audience that I've ever been in, mostly young people and mostly female, and the audience really got off on the film. You could really feel a buzz of enjoyment as they were watching the movie, and what I think is terrific about it is that for a lot of these young fans of Joker might not have seen King of Comedy, they might not have seen Taxi Driver, but if they've read about Joker, they will be introduced to those films, and they may go and check out those brilliant Scorsese movies from the past and all the other films that Joker kind of is influenced by. And I think that's a really positive thing. Obviously, the two favourite scenes in Joker would be the dancing down the steps sequence, really kind of a visceral, exciting moment, a cinematic moment from 2019, and also the terrific scene with the scissors, which is incredibly violent but also full of kind of dark humour as well. So that's my rundown of my top five favourite films of 2019. I hope you enjoyed that. Newton Talks will return.